Thank you very much for the kind invitation and to all of you for being here. I was here already, I think, in 2011, visiting Giulio at the time. The place has changed. It became larger, I think, the building, right? Probably a new wing has been built in the meanwhile. It's always nice to be here. It's one of the, it's one of the places where you want to go to discuss about interesting things. Okay, so today I decided to present a kind of overview talk about my research activities in the past few years, where the common thread is about constructing and characterizing preorders between quantum objects. You will see later what I mean by this. And in particular, I would like to show that these things can also be useful to understand some applications of quantum information theory that are getting more and more popular nowadays, namely in generalized resource theories. So let me start by telling you the guiding idea of these slides, namely that generalized resource theories can be seen as order theories, so theories that put some arrows among quantum objects. Order theories for stochastic, let's say, like probabilistic structures, okay? So you can use these ideas, of course, in classical statistics, but also in particular in quantum theory, where the theory itself is already statistical. So these things get even more importance in a sense. Okay, let me start with the prototypical example of what I have in mind. That is the preorder of majorization. Majorization is a preorder between probability distributions. So you take two probability distributions, P and Q, and you order them in non-increasing fashion. So you order their entries in a way that they just go down. And you construct these truncated sums, pk, for all k. And then you introduce the definition of majorization as follows. You say that the distribution p majorizes distribution q whenever these truncated sums are ordered in this way, for all k. In particular, it is well known that you can picture majorization preorder by using the tool of Lorentz curves that were introduced by an economist, a German economist, Max Lorentz, which is not the Lorentz of the Lorentz transformation, neither the Lorentz of Lorentz attractors. It's a third Lorentz, but he introduced these curves in order to describe originally, I think in 1905, so much before the order of majorization was found. He introduced these curves to understand the non-uniformity of wealth distribution in a country. And still now, these curves are used in demography and economy. And in particular, people, they compute some coefficients called Gini coefficients that describe how wealth is distributed in a country. Anyway, so you can, you just put these points equally spaced on the x-axis, and on the y-axis you plot the truncated sums for all k. So you start with p1, for example, the red curve can be the curve that corresponds to probability p, p1, p2, p3, p4. So p4 will be, in the case of, this is an example for four-dimensional probability distribution, so p4 will be 1, right, because you're summing up all the terms in the probability distributions. And then the majorization can be seen. So you can say, for example, that the probability distribution that corresponds to the red curve here majorizes both the green curve and the blue curve, but the order is only partial because the green curve and the blue curve can actually cross. In that case, neither probability distribution majorizes the other one, and vice versa. And then you also have the minimum element, which is the element, the probability distribution that would have a diagonal here as its Lorentz curve, which is a uniform distribution. So measurization became important and studied in mathematical statistics and also linear algebra, mostly because of a very famous theorem, firstly proved by Hardy, Littlewood, and Pollea in their book about inequalities in 1929, where they show that a probability distribution P measurizes Q if and only if there exists a bistochastic matrix M that transforms P into Q. A bistochastic matrix is a matrix that preserves probability distribution, so transforms probability distribution into probability distributions, and also keeps the uniform distribution fixed. Mm? So you can picture it as a matrix with positive entries, and if you sum them along the rows or you sum them along the columns, you always get a one. So this is very well known, and this is somehow the thing that we are going to generalize to other situations in this talk. Particularly relevant in extending the notion of measurizations to multivariate cases are a series of results that were first discovered by David Blackwell in the 50s. So let me tell you what this is all about. So David Blackwell was a mathematical statistician or a statistical mathematician. No, probably a mathematical statistician, you would say. that was interested, of course, in statistical problems, in particular estimation problems, right? So he would model statistical experiments that should give you some information about some true but unknown and directly inaccessible parameter of nature, theta, okay? So you have this theta, you don't know what is the true value of theta, so you set up an experiment that can tell you something about it. So the experiment here is kind of way to have a sneak peek, you know, to try to spy on nature. So you engineer some experiment there that will induce, depending on the value of nature, the parameter of nature theta, will induce some different distributions on a sample space that you can now directly observe. And depending on the distribution on the samples, you have to reach a decision. So this is the typical setup of so-called statistical decision problems. So a little bit more mathematically speaking, you have a parameter theta, and then through a conditional probability distribution on x given theta, you are going to have distributions over the sample space x. And then the decision, which is an active choice of the statistician, is to choose some sort of decoding function, okay, that takes the x, which is some value in the sample space, and returns a distribution over an action space u. Okay, so this is called the decision function. And then the statistical decision problem is given by means of a payoff function, which is a real function of the parameter of nature theta and of the action decided by the statistician u, and which models somehow the payoff that the statistician is going to get if he decides action u in the face of the true parameter being theta. Okay, so let's step back from this practical interpretation, and now let's just define a statistical model or experiment. Depending on the time in which the literature is written, people earlier back in the days they would speak about statistical experiment. Now we typically call them statistical models. Are given by triples, where you have a parameter space theta, the sample space x, and then you have a conditional distribution from theta to x. And the statistical decision problem, or also here people were using the name game, statistical games. Why statistical games? Because it's kind of game played between the statistician and the nature, where nature just behaves statistically. So it's completely oblivious. Nature is considered to be oblivious about the game being played. Nature is not actively trying to trick us on taking bad decisions, right? So that's why they call it statistical game. which is a triple. Again, it's given by the parameter set theta, an action set u, and a payoff function L. So somehow you see there is a kind of dual structure between statistical models and statistical decision problems, right? You can see that you can introduce some sort of inner product between the two. And now, of course, the idea is that you play games with experiments, right? So you use the experiment to extract information about theta, and you want to use this information to optimize your decision. So the idea is that the experiment is given, okay? This is kind of resource that is given to you, and you cannot change it. The best you can do with that is to optimize your decision function, D. And so in this way, we can construct an expected payoff. So the expected payoff of a statistical model W with respect to a decision problem G is given by this formula. So here you say that I just fix arbitrarily a prior distribution on theta. This is actually not important. I'm not saying that this kind of idea can only be formulated in a Bayesian approach. It's just, you know, just because you want to give a number to it. So you fix a prior distribution on theta, then you propagate theta to the sample by means of the first conditional distribution. Then you have your decision, okay? So at this point here, you have a joint distribution over ux and theta. And now here you sum over ux and theta here. Here you have your payoff function, and so you're going to get an expected payoff, maximized over decisions, because we said the decisions are free for the experimenter to choose. Okay, so now that we are able to stick a number on each statistical model, we can imagine of comparing them. So now we are given two statistical models about the same natural phenomenon. So they are both statistical models on theta, okay? And we are trying to say which one is best in order to play some fixed decision problem G. And of course, you want to compare their expected payoffs, right? But what Blackwell introduces in this paper is something a little bit, actually very much stronger than that. So he introduces now a preorder, because before, of course, this comparison can always be done, right? If you fix the decision problems, any two statistical models can be compared. So in this sense, in this way, it becomes totally ordered, right? What we want to do now is to introduce a preorder in the following way. This is called information preorder by Blackwell. So if the model W is better than model W prime for all decision problems G, then we say that W is more informative, or always more informative, than W prime. So now the idea is that we want to visualize this morphism a little bit more concretely, right? So this seems reasonable, but okay, what does it mean exactly? And here comes the result by Blackwell that was initiated together with Sherman and Stein, but then Blackwell developed these things further. So it spans like 5 years of papers. And this is the simplest way in which can be described this result. So given two experiments with the same parameter space, theta, W is more informative than W prime if and only if there exists a conditional probability distribution phi that transforms W into W prime. So in particular, it's telling us that information morphisms is equivalent to the notion of statistical sufficiency, in the sense that one experiment here, W prime, is nothing but the experiment W processed with some post-processing function. Okay. So a special but very important case of Blackwell's theorem is given when the parameter space has only two possible values. So when the set theta has only, like, for example, 0 and 1. So then you have essentially that your statistical experiment is just a pair of probability distributions, okay? In jargon, pairs of probability distributions are called dichotomies. So now this is Blackwell theorem specialized to dichotomies. It becomes even stronger in a way. You'll see why. So now what we want to compare are two pairs of probability distributions, P1 and P2, versus Q1 and Q2. And dimensions can be whatever, okay? You don't care so much. Now, remember before what we've done in majorization. In majorization, you construct a truncated sum by ordering the entries of P and Q in non-increasing order. Here, what you have to do, you have to choose a permutation for the P's and a permutation for the Q's such that these ratios now are non-increasing. Okay, you can always do that. For example, you can choose the first entry of P2 to be the smallest one of P2 and the first entry of P1 to be the largest one of P1, and then you... Actually, there are many of such good permutations. And then you construct the truncated sums in this way. So now you have four truncated sums. You just not have only two. You have one truncated sum for P1, one truncated sum for P2, and the same for Q1 and Q2. And now, the information preorder of Blackwell for these two dichotomies can be expressed in terms of these relative Lorentz curves, where now, you see, on the x-axis, you put the truncated sums for the probability P2. On the y-axis, you plot the truncated sums for probability P1. And you have this point. So now, differently from majorization is that these things are not equally spaced, of course. They depend on P1, P2, okay? They depend on the reference probabilities P2 and Q2. But they are morally the same things. Actually, you can now go back and understand Lorentz curves as these curves drawn when P2 is equal to Q2 equal to the uniform distribution. That also explains to you why Lorentz curve had equally spaced points on the x-axis, right? And now Blackwell theorem for dichotomies tells you what you would expect. It tells you that the majorization of these generalized Lorentz curves is equivalent to the existence of some stochastic matrix M that simultaneously transforms the P's into the Q's. So again, now you can understand majorization as a special case of this, because in that case, P2 equal Q2 equal the uniform, and so one constraint is that the uniform is fixed point. Okay. So this is the Blackwell's theory from dichotomies, and notice the date, 1953. Quite a long time ago. Okay, now the viewpoint of communication theory. So, formally speaking, statistical models are equivalent to noisy channels, noisy discrete channels. Why? Because they are essentially given by an input alphabet, which was the parameter space theta, an output alphabet, which is the sample space x, and then a conditional probability distribution of x given theta. So they are equivalent to noisy channels. But the viewpoint of mathematical statistics is very different from the viewpoint of information theory, because in mathematical statistics, theta is the a true, hidden, inaccessible parameter of nature, right? So you cannot do coding on theta. Nature doesn't bother with code. She doesn't want to communicate with us humans, in a sense, right? But if you go in communication theory, then a sender does code. And so it is meaningful to say, okay, let's see, I can do something on theta as well, okay? And this actually justifies the idea of constructing more general set of problems that you can consider in communication theory versus mathematical statistics. In particular, a very natural problem that you consider in communication theory is a decoding problem. So now I give you a channel W, okay? Input alphabet, output alphabet, and conditional distribution. And then I say that a decoding problem is defined by some encoding So here you have your messages, set M. You have your input to the channel alphabet X. And here you have your probabilistic encoding function. So now I have this encoding things, but now my payoff function is fixed. I have the freedom of choosing, for example, only the optimum guessing probability. So what before was a freedom in the output, you know, I had all these decision problems with a very rich structure for the payoff function. I could choose any real function as a payoff. Now I shift the freedom on the encoding side, on theta, and I fix the payoff function to be just the delta function. So now my expected payoff, given channel W for encoding E, is given as follows. So I consider the uniform distribution over messages. I encode them on X. I propagate X to Y through the channel. And then I do the decoding, probabilistic decoding, where I fix the output M to be the same as the input message M. Here I'm putting the delta function. And of course, I'm free to maximize over decoding. And I get something that we all know can be represented, can be written in terms of the conditional H mean. Okay? So I'm going to use these decoding problems to introduce.
So you're looking at the average probability of correct guessing, right? But in the noisy channel encoding theorem, that makes the statements about the worst case, right? Do you know how those two things are related? I mean, or how?
Yeah, usually you do pruning, no? I mean, you consider the average, and then you say that if the average probability of decoding is good, then at least half of the code work are well decoded with respect to the
right.
worst error.
Right. You know, if, let's say we talk about reverse channel coding or something, if those two things are still kind of equivalent?
Well, probably I'll show you how am I going to use this, okay? Okay, so in communication theory, I'm saying it is just kind of natural to consider this as a payoff function. It's a kind of games that you can play with your channel. And we can try, actually, it's not me, it's been used before, to use these games to compare the performances of noisy channels. So now you imagine to have two noisy channels with the same input alphabet X, but possibly different output alphabets Y and Z. And then you try to use the same encoding on them, and then you try to compare the decoding, how good these things are to convey the message M, basically. Okay? So there are like three preorders here. One is the notion of degradability. So there exists a distribution Z given Y such that the channel W prime can be obtained by channel W by degrading its output. Okay. Then the second one, noisiness, which was introduced by Kerner and Marton in the 70s. For all encodings here, the conditional entropy, not the mean entropy, the conditional entropy of M given Y is less than or equal to the conditional entropy of M given Z. So essentially it tells you that if you have Y, you have more information about M than if you have Z, right? And then you can just, you know, this is just a name that I invented, okay, because it's very similar to noisiness, but just I'm replacing H with H mean. So then, of course, we have that one implies two. This is just the data processing inequality, nothing more than that. Then it was proved by Kerner and Marton that two does not imply one, okay? So if you if you use as your figure of merit the conditional entropy, then it's not true that you can simulate by degradability, but only in a kind of asymptotic sense. But it holds, quite surprisingly, that if you replace H with H mean, then degradability becomes equivalent to this thing, okay? And again, this is a kind of reformulation of Blackwell theorem. Of course, you have a little bit to massage the equations in order to transform a payoff function into an encoding games. They are slightly different objects, but morally speaking, we are extending Blackwell theorem from experiments to channels. And then, of course, you can consider other ways to transform channels, to introduce orders in the set of noisy channels. You have output degrading, which is the thing that we've seen just before. So you can degrade the output of one channel into some other channel from X to Z. But you can also do input degrading, right? You can append a pre-processing channel to your channel in order to get another one. Or you can do full coding. Encoding, decoding, and shared randomness between them. This also transforms your channel into some other channel, right? This full coding way to transform channels was introduced, well, of course it's there already in Shannon's paper. I mean, coding is this, you know? And it, basically the goal of coding is to asymptotically simulate the identity channel, right? So in Shannon coding theorem can be understood as a sort of asymptotic transformation of channels, but in a very, I would say, surprisingly unknown paper in 1958, he considers also the single shot situation, where he says, okay, I have a channel W, and I want to transform it exactly into some other channel W prime by means of this coding technique. Okay? And he says, okay, this introduces a partial ordering between channels that he calls channels inclusion. Then he says, okay, let's try to consider another partial ordering between channels given by their capacity. So the channel W is better than channel W prime if the capacity of W is larger than the capacity of W prime. What is the relation between the capacity ordering and the inclusion ordering here? Of course, it says inclusion implies capacity by data processing. And then he wanted to try to prove the reverse. But the reverse would be proved only roughly 50 years later by Bennett, Aram, and you know the reverse Shannon theorem, right? But they didn't know. I talked with Charlie Bennett, and he didn't know about this paper by Shannon. He was quite surprised. He was happy to see that Shannon already thought about the question, but he wasn't able to prove it. Okay, so now I would like to come to the thing that I think interests most of the people here the most, namely quantum extensions of these ideas. So again, we can think about some morphisms between quantum channels, okay? Exactly as we did before, you can consider output degrading, so just appending a post-processing CPTP map after a given channel. You can do input degrading by adding a pre-processing CPTP map to your channel, or you can do, well, now you have more richness, a more rich variety of possible processings, right? Because now you have quantum information, classical communication, various things you can do. So for example, later on I will consider the transformation of quantum channels by means of quantum coding with forward classical communication only. So I allow for some pre-processing CPTP instrument, CP instrument, that outputs a quantum thing here, but also a classical bit of information that will be used then in the final quantum decoding to transform it into something else. So now we'll see in quantum theory, I mean, these three ideas of transformations of quantum channels, how they can be applied to interesting problems in quantum information theory, but not only, like also quantum statistical mechanics and so on. So let's start from output degradability. Okay, so let me start from the application of output degradability to the comparison of quantum statistical models. This is the first thing that I studied in this topic, where you consider quantum statistical models basically as CQ channels, where you have an accessible parameter theta that induces now not some distribution over the samples, but some family of quantum states labeled by the parameter theta. So essentially, the formulation of quantum statistical models was, and quantum statistical decision problems, was formulated, was given by Hollevo back in 73. So this is a very well established piece of quantum estimation theory. So here you have the classical case, and here you have its quantum analog. Decision problems are essentially the same kind of things. You still have a parameter space, an action space, and a payoff function. Now, experiments were given by a conditional probability distribution, that is to say a family of probability distributions. Now you have a family of states labeled by theta. Then decisions now are POVMs, right? And you have that the probability that you can get classical is written by this, the probability that you can get the joint probability action parameter that you get from a quantum ensemble is given by this. Okay, you just use the Born rule. And the expected payoffs are written in this way. So nothing special, just that a statistical experiment becomes a family of quantum states and decision functions become POVM. And now you can compare quantum statistical models. So you can compare two families of quantum states, for example, rho theta and sigma theta. And they can be defined on different Hilbert spaces. So first of all, you can say, OK, I just take Blackwell's information ordering and apply it in this case. So I say that E is more informative than E prime, if and only if the expected payoff you get from E is larger than the expected payoff you get from E prime for all statistical decision problems G. OK, what does it mean? In the classical case, it told you about the existence of a simultaneous stochastic transformation of the P's into the Q's. Here, what you have is something weaker. It just tells you that there exists a quantum statistical morphism, essentially a positive map that transforms the rho's into the sigmas, OK? Not a CPTP map. In order to have a CPTP map, you have to introduce a notion of complete information ordering. That is to say, you're not happy only with information ordering of E versus E prime, period, full stop, but you want to be able to compare E versus E prime when they're both supplemented by some ancillary statistical model F. And again, this must be true for any ancillary model you provide them. And now, this complete information ordering is, in fact, equivalent to the existence of a CPTP map that simultaneously transforms the rho's into the sigmas. And you can prove that if E prime is commutative, is abelian, then the complete information ordering is equivalent to the simple vanilla information ordering. So it is really something that mimics very much the notion of complete positivity, that is positivity with respect to any possible extension. Did all the sigmas commute? Okay. So this is what you get when you extend Blackwell theorem to quantum statistical models. But you can say, OK, I want to consider output degrading of quantum channels, right? So how can we compare now quantum channels, fully quantum channels, with quantum input and quantum output? OK, one way is to introduce now these quantum decoding problems. So now the input is a bipartite state, omega RA. R, the reference, just flies there untouched, while A is fed through the channel. And then here is your decision. Your decision is the choice of the decoding here, such that the final state, which will be on R and R bar, which is a copy of R, has optimum overlap with the maximally entangled state. So this is actually how you compute the quantum capacity of a channel, right? The entanglement generation capacity of a channel, right? It's exactly like that. You start with a quantum code, which is essentially a bipartite state, and then you want to get the optimal overlap with the maximal entangled state. And more formally, we define quantum decoding problems as follows. So it's given essentially by a bipartite state, omega RA. And the payoff function is the optimum singlet fraction, which again, we know probably I didn't put it here. Oh, yeah. I didn't put it here, but also this can be written, as a negative exponential of the H mean of R given B. Right. And so now you have the following result for quantum channels. It tells you that a channel n can be degraded into channel n prime if and only if for any bipartite state omega RA, the singlet fraction you can get from n is larger than the singlet fraction you get from n prime. That is, in terms of mean entropies, if and only if for all omega RA, the mean entropy of R given B is not larger than the mean entropy of R given B prime. And this result has applications to the theory of open quantum system dynamics, we'll see in a second, but also quantum thermodynamics. So this is kind of like the central thing, and then this can be applied to some problems of more applied interest. So open quantum system dynamics, one situation in which this result can be useful is when you consider the divisibility of a stochastic process. So what is a discrete time stochastic process? So you can see it as the evolution of a classical system in time. So you have various instants in time, T0, T1, up to Tn, for example. And at each time, you have a label, Xi, that essentially tells you in which state your system is at that time. Okay? Now, a classical condition, like a classical stochastic process, is given by a joint distribution over all these labels. And you can say that, OK, typically I assume that I have full control of my system at time t0. And so it's actually a condition of probability distributions in this way. Now, if the system is quantum, unfortunately, we cannot define a multi-time density matrix, right? We can only fix the density matrix at some point and then give the channels that propagate it at subsequent times. And so a quantum stochastic process is given by a quantum dynamical mapping, which is a family of CPTP maps that propagate your system from T0 to Ti, right? These are these blue arrows, okay? Each blue arrow is a CPTP map, and the family, the sequence of all these maps give you a mathematical description of your quantum stochastic process. And now a very important property that quantum stochastic processes can or cannot satisfy, and it is important to tell if this property is satisfied or not, is the property of divisibility. So your quantum dynamical mapping is divisible if it can be broken up into a concatenation of maps that propagate your system from T0 to T1, T1 to T2, T2 to T3, and into subsequent times, step by step. Why this is important? Because it models the property of being memoryless, in the sense that, for example, if your evolution is divisible, you can say that the state at time T2 only depends on the state at time T1. And not on previous time. So this is important. And indeed, there has been a flourishing of, actually, this is what people also call Markovianity, even though there are some kind of disagreements about what truly quantum Markovianity means. But let's say that morally speaking, divisibility is Markovianity. And there's been a flourishing of literature about quantum Markovianity. And one of the problems there was to provide a fully information theoretic characterization of divisibility. There were like necessary conditions for divisibility, but not sufficient ones, like this Breuer trace norm criterion. I mean, they would witness non-Markovianity, but they would not tell you whether your process is Markovian. And what I've showed you before instead can give you a fully information theoretic characterization of divisibility, right? Because now you can say, okay, I can prepare a bipartite state here. The reference is, as always, the reference is sitting there just waiting for a system Q to be evolved through the quantum stochastic process, which is this fancy arrow here. And now what you want to do is to monitor the entanglement between these two in time. So if this entanglement between R and Q is monotonically non-increasing in time, you can say there is a sort of quantum information flow going away from your bipartite system in time. If this is true for any initial condition, then you can conclude that the evolution is divisible. Okay? So this was one situation in which this result found a good application. Another situation is about finding a set of entropic conditions that guarantee the existence of a thermal transformation between two states, so-called the problem of quantum thermal. Okay, so the idea is to characterize thermal accessibility from rho to sigma by comparing two dichotomies, rho gamma and sigma gamma, where gamma is the thermal state. Okay? Well, in particular, you can also imagine that there is a gamma before and a gamma after. So also the thermal state might change, but that's not a big problem here. Okay? Why? Because in the classical case, that is the thing. I mean, this is the thermomajorization of Jonathan and Michal, right? If rho and gamma commute, you are falling back onto Blackwell's theorems for dichotomies, and we know since 1953 that just by comparing rho gamma and sigma gamma, if they commute, if they're just probability distribution, it gives you the condition for the existence of a thermal process. So now the idea, okay, now we have some tools to deal with non-commuting things, so let's try to study quantum thermal by using the comparison of dichotomies. And the problem is that while classically, essentially, Gibbs preservation is all you need for a process to be thermal, in the quantum case, that's not enough, because you also have to account for changes in coherence, right? Because a thermal process cannot coherently mix eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, right? So how can we shoehorn? So the problem now is to try to shoehorn this coherence constraint into the comparison of dichotomies. Okay, this can be done in various ways, but the way that we did in this paper with Gilad Gur, David Jennings, Rong Yao Duan, and Iman Marvian is to treat coherence as symmetry, which we know is not exactly the same thing, but it is as close as we could get. So again, consider, so how does it work? So sketch idea, the paper is quite messy, but just to give you an idea of how it works. So let's go back to the problems of these quantum decoding problems. So you start with a arbitrary state omega, half of it goes through a channel, and then you have a decoding, and then you check the overlap with the maximally entangled state. So now the idea is that we have dichotomies. We don't have channels. But you can do a simple trick. You can say that if I give you a dichotomy, essentially I'm giving you a CQ channel that prepares either gamma or rho, or gamma and sigma. Right? So actually, the comparison of two quantum dichotomies can be formulated as the comparison of two CQ channels that work in this way. And now to add symmetry constraints. So here, already at this step, you could use all the formalism of the singlet fraction, right? I mean, we would have already a set of entropic conditions that tells you whether you can transform rho and gamma into sigma and gamma. But now we want to put symmetry constraints. And how do you do that? Well, instead of considering the singlet fraction only of this half here, you do the twirled version of it. So here you have UG and U bar, the complex conjugate. Why you do that? Because, well, we're lucky enough that this guy here is the maximally entangled state. So you can do the ricochet trick. So you can ricochet U bar onto the phi plus and make it bounce back here after the decoding. And so what you're doing here, if you're checking the singlet fraction of this twirled bipartite state here, you're actually checking the singlet fraction with respect to symmetrized decodings here. So it becomes the map you get becomes automatically covariant. And so you can say that rho was transformed into sigma by means of a covariant map.
Explain why the trolling happened before the decoding
instead of after? Because the decoding somehow is optimized. You optimize on the decoding, right? So the singlet fraction is given just by the H mean between this part and this part before the decoding, right? So then what I do is to consider the H mean after twirling, right? I do the H mean after the twirling. This will give me a different numerical value. But I know that somehow if I do the singlet fraction of a twirled state, it means that I'm doing the singlet fraction by using a covariant decoding. So it's like saying, if you're computing the singlet fraction of a state that is already twirled, without loss of generality, you can restrict yourself to a covariant decoding. That's somehow, everything is symmetric there. So also your decoding map can be chosen without loss of generality to be symmetric with respect to the same group. So by doing this twirling here, we are guaranteeing in a sense that you are not losing anything if you restrict your D to be covariant. Maybe I can show you later. This is a very sketchy slide, so sorry. But I can show you later with a little bit of time, if you're interested. So this is how we shoehorned symmetry into this quantum black hole thing, by doing twirling. There are other possibilities. If you want, we can discuss about it later. And then, of course, you can say that all those H mean that I showed you before, they provide, these things provide a complete set of entropic monotones for the existence of a symmetric Gibbs preserving transformation from rho to sigma.
So just to clarify, so in your channel, you're inputting your perceived states, no?
Yes.
And then the decoding is the optimization over all covariant operations, right?
Yes. Yes. Okay, and then as a final and as the final part, I would like to show you instead how the most general coding, so that quantum coding with forward classical communication, can found some applications in probing correlations in space-time. So first of all, it found application in the characterization of entanglement in terms of its non-local content, its ability to violate Bell tests, okay? So the idea here is that Bell tests, so what are Bell tests? Everyone knows here, I'm sure, but so that you have a source that is sending some particle to Alice, another particle to Bob, which are space-like separated. And then Alice is given question X, Bob is given question Y, and they have to answer with A and B, and then they will be evaluated with respect to some payoff function L. So the idea is that it is possible to see essentially Bell tests as distributed decision problems, right? Because Bob knows Y, but he does not know X, of course, right? So it's a sort of, you know, X plays the role of theta for Bob. You know, that hidden value of nature that Bob needs to have in order to decide B as best as it can, okay? So Bell tests can be considered as distributed decision problems. And so it's very natural to try to see what this idea of Blackwell theorem tells us in the case of Bell tests. So in the case of Bell test, we know very well that with a classical source lambda, the input-output probability distributions that can be obtained by Alice and Bob if they cannot communicate are given by this. Okay? So you have a decision function for Alice that can only depend on x and lambda, and a decision function for Bob that can only depend on b, on y and lambda, of course, right? Because they cannot communicate otherwise. If the source is quantum, you have this way to write things. So you have that correlations are described by a bipartite quantum state, and then you have some measurement going on in Alice's laboratory and another measurement going on in Bob's laboratory. And then you can compute the payoff that you expect to get from each state for any Bell tests in this way. So you have you put some uniform distribution over the questions, then you have your input-output probability distribution, of any classical or quantum, depends on the p, pi, you know, and the rho here, and then the payoff function that is, this is essentially, you know, the witness in the correlation space. And you maximize over decision. So you can maximize over dA and dB, or you can maximize over pA, qB in the quantum case. This will give you how much your state is able to win that Bell game. So then it's natural to make it quantum, as we've done before, right? Before, the parameter space theta was mapped into a set of states, and here we do the same. So we take that the questions now are given to the players as quantum states. So Alice receives tau x, Bob receives omega y, and again they have to optimize their decisions to output A and B, which are classical, okay? So with a classical source, you have this. The classical source is just common randomness here. With a quantum source, you have this thing. So you can have actually bipartite measurements on Alice and her questions, and Bob and his question space Y, right? And again, you can compute the expected payoff that you get. So this is the theorem that is proved in the same spirit. Of course, the techniques are different because you are comparing different things, but the spirit is the same as before. So you can prove that given two bipartite states, rho and sigma, then rho is going to give you more non-locality than sigma in all semi-quantum non-local games, if and only if there exists a sequence of CPTP maps on A and a sequence of CPTP maps on B and the distribution pi lambda such that sigma can be obtained from rho in this way. So it means that sigma can be obtained from rho by means of local operations with shared randomness. So somehow in this operational scenario, you can say that we are constructing a kind of resource theory of quantum non-locality, or the non-locality in quantum states. So there are some corollaries here that are interesting. So first of all, because of the construction, for any separable state gives you as much good as a tensor product state, okay? So like essentially, separable states, they give you nothing more than nothing, okay? They give you nothing, basically. But for any entangled state, then there must exist at least one semi-quantum non-local game that is able to witness its entanglement. So somehow, this was a way to close the gap between non-local states and entangled states. It's a way to close the gap that I provided here. And this was actually the reason why this paper became famous, because then no one cared about the existence of LOSR. That for me was the most important result, but everyone just looked at this. Okay, and there are other nice properties that were discovered by Denis and Cyril and Yongchen Liang and Nicolas Gisin of these semi-quantum non-local games. So that first of all, they have a very nice operational interpretation. They can be considered as measurement, device independent, entanglement witness, in the sense that the referee now, if I want to witness the entanglement of this source, I just be able to prepare the tau and omega to high accuracy. And then I don't care about the measurements. The measurement can be very lossy, they can be very bad, they can be very different from what I think they are, and still, if I violate my bound, I'm sure that my state is entangled. So I only have to trust preparation, and it's much easier to trust preparation than a measurement, because preparation can do post-selection. So you can keep post-selecting until your states are good, and indeed, people can prepare much better than one they can measure. So it's very good from the practical viewpoint. For the same reason, they can withstand losses in the detectors, which instead are very nasty for Bell tests, conventional Bell tests. But even more important, semi-quantum no-local games can withstand any amount of classical communication exchange between Alice and Bob. And you know that in conventional Bell tests, if just Alice is able to communicate her question to Bob, then they become true, right? Because they can simulate any input-output correlation. Whereas here, the fact that the questions are encoded on quantum states, it can be indistinguishable, right? Prevent Alice and Bob from cheating by communicating classically. Okay? So it seems nice to try to now to turn the semi-quantum no-local games from being arranged space-like with Alice and Bob separated in space in a time-like fashion where instead Alice and Bob are only separated by time, right? Because the problem when you do that, I mean, people have been considering time-like Bell inequalities, right? Which is like the Leggett-Garg inequality. And the nasty point of that is that the communication loophole in Bell tests, so the fact that Alice and Bob must not communicate to play the Bell test, becomes the clumsiness loophole there. I mean, the particle before can keep memory of the fact that it was measured, right? And can cheat you with the outcome later on. So the communication loophole becomes the clumsiness loophole for Leggett-Garg inequality, and this is known to be a very nasty feature of these time-like Bell inequalities. Basically, you cannot really get rid of it. But with these things, maybe you can, and yeah, we provided together with Denis a construction that seems to close this thing. Okay, so now we consider, again, semi-quantum games, but played not between Alice and Bob, space-like separated, but between Alice now and Alice later. Okay, so now here it's an arrow of time. Okay, but for all the rest, for what it matters, the game is defined as before. So you have quantum states that encodes the questions and then classical answers. So it works as follows. I first give tau x to Alice, and she has to output, okay, so this is semi-quantum signaling games, let's call them signaling games. So for a while, imagine that there is no channel here. So Alice has no quantum memory to play with. She can only keep track of classical things, like the classical outcome A. So what she will do, I give her tau x at some time t0, so she will measure a first measurement here, outputting A. Okay, there could be some classical random variable that she keeps in mind, she stores in her memory, classical memory. And then after a while, when I provide her with the second quantum questions, omega y, she can perform another measurement that now can depend indeed on the previous outcome, right? Because nothing prevents Alice from memorizing A and use A in the second measurement, right? But now the interesting thing is what happens when Alice has a quantum memory available. What is a quantum memory? It's just a quantum channel, right? That she can use. What she can do more than before? Well, she can do a strategy like the following. So I give her the first question, tau x. So now she will perform an instrument on it. So like a channel with a classical output, but also a quantum output. The quantum output will be propagated through N. And then it will be used again when I give Alice the second question, omega y. Okay? And she will do a final measurement here. So if you write the global formula is a little bit clumsy to write, but it's not difficult. So you start with tau x, you apply the first measurement. This has a quantum output and a classical output. The quantum output is piped through the quantum memory, whereas the classical output is used in the final measurement here, which is, by the way, a joint measurement on the quantum output here and the second question. Right? So she's using everything to produce B. So here are just the two situations compared one to the other. And if you look into them a bit carefully, you see that the classical strategy is completely equivalent to the case in which the channel N is entanglement breaking. If the channel N is entanglement breaking, you see that actually only some classical memory is actually propagated from time t0 to time t1. So it can be encoded in some output, right? And indeed, these time-like semi-quantum games provide a complete operational scenario for the resource theory of entanglement breaking channels. Okay, again, in the spirit of Blackwell theorem, you can introduce a pre-ordering, a signaling pre-order between channels, given in terms of the semi-quantum signaling games. Okay, and it is possible to prove that this is equivalent to the existence of a quantum coding assisted by forward classical communication that transforms the first channel into the second. So you see, if you write it in this way, it is self-evident that entanglement breaking channels are for free. Even if I don't give you here anything, even if this channel is the completely depolarizing channel, like this is like a stumbling block here. Nothing goes from A to B. Even in that case, this structure can give you any entanglement breaking channel for free. Right? In a sense, it's kind of entanglement breaking coding, EB morphism, I call them here, just to keep the theme of the So some resource about this final thing, resource theory of quantum memories. So this is a resource theory where all and only measure and prepare channels are free. And in particular, if your channel is not entanglement breaking, then there exists a semi-quantum game that can witness this feature. So now we have really a perfect analogy between separable states and entanglement breaking channels, because we have essentially the same games that just formulated from space-like to time-like are able to witness both things. And then what I just said before is that I think that there is some good connection with Leggett-Garg inequalities, right? The clumsiness loophole that is there in Leggett-Garg inequality, which is essentially the fact that in the space like you have the communication loophole, can be closed by using quantum questions. And in particular, these semi-quantum games can really treat space-like and time-like quantum correlation on equal footing. I can just say, okay, I want to check whether in between these two like space-time points here, there is some kind of quantum channel. Is there quantum communicate quantum information propagating from this event to this event? I can just, you know, ask the agent here some quantum question, then ask the agent here some quantum question, and compare the input-output correlations and check. Okay, conclusion. So I gave you some sort of big overview about how these ideas can be used in various things, in various applications. So the main idea is that the theory of statistical comparison studies morphisms, in the sense of pre-orders, of one statistical structure X into another structure Y. So equivalent conditions are given in terms of, and these can be finitely or infinitely many, monotones that are functions of X that must be compared with the corresponding functions on Y. So such monotones can tell you something about the resources at stake in your operational framework, right? Then, of course, some of them are easier to interpret. Some of them are much more complicated and involuted to inverted, convoluted to inverted. Perhaps it's because your operational framework was not chosen very well. I mean, there is no one fixed recipes. Just there is a main general idea that keeps coming up in all these things. But one thing that I would like to comment upon to conclude my talk today is the connection with semi-definite programming, right? Because then people say, okay, here you have to compare sometimes finitely many if you're lucky, but sometimes you really need an infinitely many monotones, resource monotones to decide the existences of a transformation from X to Y. But in many situations, actually the existence can be efficiently verified by means of SDP. So why don't you use SDP? Well, I tell you, yes, of course, if you're just interested in deciding whether you can go from X to Y with a particular set of transformations, then you should definitely use SDP. But SDP tells you nothing about the resources at stake. The resource formalism really wants to decouple X from Y. You want to be able to compute some resources that only depend on X and the same resources that only depend on Y and compare those. You don't want to have a function that depends on both. This wouldn't tell you anything about the resources that are there working in your theory. So I would say that they are both important. Both the SDP formulation of a resource theory is important because it gives you a condition that can be efficiently checked. But also the monotone formulation of your resource theory is important because that is where your resources are measured and you want to know about that. And with this, I would like to.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so surprised because the temporal correlation you are working on is exactly, is almost the same I'm working on.
Oh, brilliant.
Yes. I'm working on a space-time formulation called pseudo-density matrix formulation. It is trying to treat space and time on an equal footing, especially to try to treat temporal correlation just as spatial correlation. And the conditional probability you present in the temporal case is exactly the same we calculated in our formulation.
I see. Very interesting.
Yeah, I'm so happy to see you.
So I'm looking forward to discuss with you more about that maybe later on. Yep.
So instead of saying complementary to SDP, it might be actually dual to SDP.
It is.
Because these monotones, if you formulate as an SDP and then you take the dual, it's basically optimizing over these monotones. Or,
yes, yes.
Marsh's lemma or whatever. Like
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
yes.
Some kind of.
Actually, yes. I mean, when you work them out, it always looks like, you know, it really looks like when you're doing the dual thing. Then I'm no expert at all about SDP, but I'm sure that. So that's not by chance that I use the word dual somewhere, right? Did I? Did I? No, okay. But somewhere else, I really put a slide where I said that, you know, the monotones approach is somewhat dual to SDP. I wanted to say a little bit more formal than that, but then you can confirm that. The hunch was kind of right.
Closely related to that, do you know if Blackwell's theorem is an instance of linear programming duality?
If your problem is to check whether there exists a simultaneous transformation from a family of density matrices to another family of density matrices?
No, I'm talking about Blackwell's theorem, the classical, the old one.
The original one?
By
linear duality, you mean if it can be formulated as an SDP, basically?
No, if Blackwell's theorem is an instance of linear programming duality. So the existence of such a stochastic matrix is a linear program.
Yes.
You can dualize it. You got an equivalent linear program where the feasibility translates.
I'm not aware of that, but I think there should be somewhere in the literature.
Yeah, sure.
But it.
Yes.
Yeah. So just a comment on this comparison you're making between, witnessing convertibility relations between some pair of resources and having a set of monotones. So in recent work we've done at PI on a resource theory of non-locality, we came to the conclusion that yes, monotones can do something for you that just having a program to witness that can't do. And the way I would put it is that there are some global properties of the pre-order
right.
that you can't easily deduce from an algorithm. Right? So if you, you know, so the examples that we looked at, you know, what's the width of your pre-order? Is it infinite width? Is it infinite height? You know, even is it, you know,
okay, that's a very good point.
Ordered or not? Is it locally infinite? There's all these sort of global properties of the pre-order, which in principle, by a brute force search, you could try to answer them with pairs, but it's much easier if you have some monotones. You know, as soon as you find
very good point.
Monotones, you know it's not totally ordered.
Very good point. I will incorporate this point as well in a future presentation of this talk. Very good point, yes.
Can you say a little bit what you mean by a generalized resource theory? Do you have some definition in mind?
Well, generalized resource theories, as I said, I mean, you start with some
what
set of
states.
So typically, you start from a set of free operations that you can do, right? Mm-hmm. And these somehow, if your resource theory is, I think, reasonably defined, they should also tell you what states are free. Right? Mm-hmm. Typically, this transformation can generate some states for free. So you have, by giving free operations, you're also giving free states. Okay. And then, essentially, the whole game is to say, if I have now in my structure, right, because transformations can be defined on a single system, but then you can imagine that your actual theory has many systems, you know, like many qubits, for example, right? Or families of states, not just one state and so on. So now you have some statistical structure on your theory, and you want to say whether you can transform one into another by means of these free operations that you defined before. Okay? This is a resource theory somehow, like the backbone of
so
a resource
no
theory.
So there's no difference between a resource theory and a generalized resource theory?
Yes, I use the word generalized in a very sloppy way, in the sense that before people would think about resource theories as, for example, entanglement, LOCC,
to emphasize
that it's more general than what people have been usually thinking about, yes?
So in many of the instances you show this, you have this h-mean, and then you have to, the statement is for all states, no?
Yes.
So you have to check for all states. But do you know if, is there an example where you have like some efficiently computable rate?
Well, yes, it must hold for all states, but you can prove that actually it only has to be checked for a compact set of such states. I mean,
right.
You really don't have, it's not like a completely, you know, impossible task. Sometimes you can, actually always you can reduce only to a compact set of states. So you know that there will be some points that you can find, and sometimes you can even go further and you can show that there exists only finite set of conditions to check.
So for instance, in the cases of the thermodynamics.
The thermodynamics, yes.
Or the divisibility ones, are those examples of this?
Yeah, for example, for the divisibility, so you are saying, I think that your question is, so I give you an evolution that is not divisible, so come up with a bipartite state that is able to witness that, probably.
I'm not sure.
Right? Because that is usually the problem, no?
I guess more if I give you.
Because right. you will never. Yeah? Yeah. That really depends on. Like, already, for example, think about the case of entanglement, right? So, semi quantum non local games can be constructed starting from an entanglement witness. So, if you have an entangled state and you want to construct an entanglement witness for that state, well. Maybe if you already know the state, then maybe yes, you can. But still, it's not so, right? I mean, it's of the same order of difficulty as finding a good entanglement witness.
So I guess what I wonder if solving the SDP is usually easier in practice than taking these HMEs.
Oh, yes. Well, the SDP is, in a sense, if you have the set of transformation that can be represented nicely in terms of an SDP, then it's kind of trivial, no? Because X is given, Y is given, and you just want to say whether your function is above or below a threshold. So yes, if one is only interested about the accessibility of Y from X, then SDP is definitely the way to go. But what I'm saying is that does not tell you, I mean, it's difficult to interpret then in terms of what's going on, what are the resources being used. Yes.
Any further questions?
Okay. Thanks, Vikram.
Thank you.